Today's episode of Suspect Convictions is brought to you by Simple Contacts. For $30 off your next pair of eye contacts, just go to simplecontacts.com/suspect. Again, simplecontacts.com/suspect.
I saw my three older daughters because they were running around and they were screaming. But my baby daughter, I was having a hard time getting to her because the house was so much in smoke and fire and flames.
People learned or thought they learned how to investigate fires from basically their buddies down at the firehouse. Yeah, it's impossible to cross-examine a dog.
So if she had been, you know, a middle-class housewife and had a husband who was off on a business trip and her house burned down, she would be treated a little bit differently than a single mom with many kids working three jobs just trying to make it.
I've seen officers beat up inmates down to officers having affairs with inmates.
The judge said that she felt like justice had prevailed in this case.
Rochelle Casey is a woman who has suffered much. In July 2001, the Corning, New York woman's duplex erupted into flames. She escaped the blaze with three of her four children, but her fourth, 7-month-old Kiara Casey Lawton, died in the fire. Corning, a rural upstate community of 11,000, sits to the Pennsylvania border and is known throughout the world for the glass and ceramic products manufactured there. Rochelle, who is African American, stood out in this community that is only 3% Black. Today's hosts are Suspect Convictions founder Scott Reeder and guest host Kristen Bunch, who was wrongly convicted of an Indiana arson and murder in 1995 for the death of her son, Tony. 2001 was a tumultuous time in American history. A Beautiful Mind was popular at the box office.
John Nash was one of the most brilliant minds of his generation.
Welcome to Princeton. Who among you will be the next Einstein?
Find a truly original idea, and it's the only way I will ever distinguish myself. It's the only way I will ever matter.
He saw the world.
And where's Nash?
Out there, looking for his original idea.
In ways that no one could imagine.
This flies in the face of 150 years of theory.
Congratulations, John.
It's the achievement of a lifetime.
Lifehouse's Hanging by a Moment topped the music charts. And terrorism came to the U.S. shores.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
I just saw another plane coming in from the side.
You did. That was out of my
Yes, and that's
view.
The second explosion. You could see the plane come in just from the right-hand side of the screen. So this looks like some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center that is underway.
Arson investigators scoured the fire Corning, New York scene with dogs and quickly came to the conclusion that an accelerant had been poured on the duplex and purposely ignited. Rochelle was charged with arson and murder. It took prosecutors three trials to convict Rochelle. The first two ended in hung juries. She was sentenced to 25 years to life. Even after being convicted, she maintained her innocence. Two professors at Cornell Law School's Innocence Clinic investigated her claims and believed her. They determined the conviction was based on faulty science, and after 13 years of incarceration, they managed to gain Rochelle's release. Here's what Rochelle remembers about that fateful night in July 2001.
At the time, I was working three jobs, I have three kids. I woke up in the middle of the night, and, well, actually, my daughter woke me up. My oldest daughter at the time was 4 and a half. She was getting ready to be 5. And my house was on fire. So I was very disoriented, and I was trying to find, because I saw my three older daughters because they were running around and they were screaming. But my baby daughter, I was having a hard time getting to her because the house was so much in smoke and fire and flames. So what I did is I knew the room that she was sleeping at. So I took my other three out the front door because we were closer to the front of the house. And my daughter was towards the end of the house. And I planned on running around, breaking the window, and going in and getting my daughter that way. But I didn't realize that once I had gone outside and I had broke the window, I had jumped and I punched the window out. I couldn't get to her because the ledge was too high. So then I just kept trying to go in until it was actually, it was almost as if the glass or the side of the thing, it was melting. It was like so hot, I stayed right there until the firemen and police, and there was a lot of people around, and they pulled me and they made me go across the street. And I remember all these ambulances. And then after that, it was almost as if I had a lapse in time, because I know that they kept giving me shots because they said I wouldn't calm down. And then I woke up and I was at my mother's house.
Then you said that at some point the police started pointing fingers. When did that start happening?
Well, it almost started in the beginning because they kept questioning me. They wanted me to do a walk-in, and they wanted me to tell them what happened, and I could not tell them because I was asleep. So I know my father had come up here from Tennessee, and he tried to talk to them too. And honestly, it was just, because where my case happened, it was in a small town upstate New York, and they didn't really want to, they just wanted it closed.
Rochelle not only faced the intense pressure of potentially spending the rest of her life in prison, but she was still mourning the loss of her youngest child.
She was very light-skinned. She had a real nice texture hair. It wasn't coarse like African-American, and it wasn't as like Caucasian, was like in the middle. It was wavy. She was beautiful. I have her face tattooed on my leg. She had a cute little personality. She was, right before all this had happened, she had gotten to the point where she was so spoiled that she would cry until you acknowledged her, and then when you would get up next to her, she would just smile. You didn't even have to pick her up. She just wanted you to be there with her and pay her all your attention.
The case hinged not on a laboratory test or a witness testimony. It hinged on a dog's nose. Rochelle's lawyer, Keir Wabel, explains that the forensic techniques used at the fire scene were deeply flawed.
Immediately post-fire, the local authorities dispatched a person who I guess ostensibly was their best. As it turns out, not too far from where this fire occurred sits the New York State Fire Academy, the place where they send firefighters to be trained in, among other things, post-fire investigation. And so that the person that they sent to conduct this investigation is one of the trainers at the Fire Academy. So, as I said, ostensibly he was among their best. As we later determined, their best wasn't very good. But the investigation that he conducted consisted of sort of walking the scene over a period of a couple of days with his accelerant detection dog and sort of looking around and taking pictures. And the What eventually came out of the investigation and what was featured at trial were sort of two sets of observations or characteristics from the scene collected by him. One was that his dog alerted at 9 different points in and around the fire scene. And that alert was interpreted by him as concrete proof that a liquid accelerant had been poured there in those spots. And then he confirmed that for himself by observing what he called pour patterns, which look like sort of swirl patterns on the burned floor of the duplex. And he put those two things together, applied his knowledge, such as it was, and came away with the firm belief that what he had seen, the combination of the dog alerts and the swirl patterns, was indicative of the presence of liquid accelerant. And there were a variety of problems with that. The most immediate one, and the one that probably should have been seen right away, is that there's a very well-settled protocol in fire investigation having to do with the use of accelerant-detecting dogs. And dogs do have very good noses, and they can be trained to pick out specific things, but they only get so discriminating. And so the rule is that when a dog alerts, a sample must be taken from that location, and it must be tested by actual laboratory equipment and confirmed to be accelerant rather than some other byproduct of burning material. And absent laboratory confirmation, it's not to be mentioned in court because it's too likely to be misleading. And it's just not good evidence of an accelerant unless it's been confirmed in the lab.
It's pretty hard to cross-examine a dog.
It's impossible to cross-examine a dog. So in this case, samples were taken. He followed the first part of the protocol, and he took samples from all 9 locations and sent them to the state crime lab for analysis. And none of those 9 were confirmed as liquid accelerant. That, however, did not prevent the investigator from mentioning and relying upon all 9 of them in his testimony to the jury. And unfortunately, none of that was challenged by Ms. Casey's defense counsel, who himself did not know about those protocols.
Fire science has not developed in the same manner as another field, Wabel contends.
It starts with the junk science. You know, there are a number of these kinds of cases around the country, and I don't think all of them have been identified yet. You know, fire science, as I came to understand it from doing the work in this case, and before that I really didn't know much about it either. I had to sort of learn it. But fire science really is a tale of kind of two eras, and an old guard and a newer guard. And the old guard from the old era operated outside of science. And people learned or thought they learned how to investigate fires from basically their buddies down at the firehouse. And this kind of mythology or this set of beliefs that really don't have any basis in science grew up, took hold, and got passed down from generation to generation. Things like if you look at the floor and you see a swirl pattern, then it must be what's left over from burning liquid that flowed around the floor. No one ever, for many years, no one tested that. No one stopped to ask the question, I wonder if that's really right or if there might be some other explanation for this. They just sort of took it on faith and assumed it was true. And a similar phenomenon with the dog. They placed more faith in the dog alerts than, as it turns out, science warranted. And there was an awakening about the lack of scientific basis in fire science, really, I think, as far back as the late 70s and into the 1980s. And some more conscientious, science-minded people got together and said, you know, it shouldn't be this way. If we're going to be in this field and call ourselves, hold ourselves out as trustworthy and reliable when we conduct these investigations and report our results, then we ought to be able to back this stuff up with some science. And so they started doing the science, and they pretty quickly figured out that a lot of those old myths were wrong. So, for example, in this case, the what was observed, that the swirls on the floor that were reported as pour patterns were not pour patterns at all. And in fact, they were very classic leftovers from a phenomenon called flashover, which is when a fire in a contained space reaches a critical sort of stage of heating. So if you think about it, fire, of course, heat goes up, right? And if it has no place to go because it's hitting the ceiling, it's going to continue to accumulate up there on the ceiling. And at the same time, it's radiating heat downward. And once the heat up high gets high enough and the radiation downward gets strong enough, the stuff at the bottom, anything inflatable or ignitable at the bottom on the floor, essentially spontaneously bursts into flames. And through lots of controlled experimentation and observation, it's been determined that the results of flashover on a floor are indistinguishable from the swirl patterns that someone from the old guard would expect to find from ignitable liquid. So you can't look at those patterns and come away certain that what you're seeing is the results of an ignitable liquid, because more likely than not, it's actually flashover. And in this case, there were all of the telltale signs of flashover. So this was, you know, just basic misinterpretation, because the state's investigator was not trained in the science. He was one of those guys who learned what he learned from his buddies down at the firehouse.
There are a million things demanding your time. Contact lenses shouldn't be one of them. That's why we're excited about a great new company called Simple Contacts that's making the process of renewing your prescription and buying contacts, well, really simple. Simple Contacts is the most convenient way to get your contact lens prescription renewed and stock up on your brand of contact lenses. Get this, instead of taking time off and spending hours at the doctor just to renew your prescription, you can get it done online in under 5 minutes. This is vision care for the 21st century. Here's how it works. Take a quick, self-guided vision test from your phone or computer. It's reviewed by a licensed doctor within 24 hours. You receive a renewed prescription and reorder your brand of contacts. It's that simple, folks. If you have an unexpired prescription, you can use that too. Just upload a photo of it or your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes for a great price. They do all the hard work for you. Buying more contacts has never been easier, and why should it have been hard in the first place? That's why Simple Contacts was created. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses, and their prices are unbeatable. Plus, the prescription is just $20 compared to an annual appointment, which can cost more than $200 at a regular doctor's place if you don't have insurance. Shipping is free, and best of all, my listeners get $30 off their first Simple Contacts order. To save $30 off your lenses, just go to simplecontacts.com/suspect or enter the code SUSPECT at checkout. I want to mention, this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. You still need those occasionally, but it is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and reorder your contacts. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $30 off by going to simplecontacts.com/suspect or just enter suspect at checkout. Save yourself time, money, and a headache with Simple Contacts.
Not only was the evidence used to convict Rochelle questionable, but so were the tactics employed by the Corning police.
They were almost as if they were trying to be manipulative. And I say that because I lived at that time in a white community, very Caucasian community. And they went as far as to get an African-American woman to say that she was an arson investigator, to say that my story could not be true, when ultimately she was just an officer from a different force.
We are now joined by Scott Reeder and Kristen Bunch.
Well, I guess the first thing that runs through my mind is it reminded me a lot of your case. Did you see some similarities as well?
I saw a lot of similarities. It broke my heart that another mother had to go through the same thing that I did. and that the justice system would just automatically focus in on a grieving mother and, I feel like, take advantage of the situation.
Why do you think the system focused in right away on a grieving mom?
Well, honestly, in my opinion, I think they make judgment calls based on the character of the person. So if she had been, you know, a middle-class housewife and had a husband who was off on a business trip and her house burned down, she would be treated a little bit differently than a single mom with many kids working three jobs just trying to make it.
So one of the things that troubles me, too, is the... there's a lot of things that trouble me about this, but one of the things is, you know, and this has troubled me about some police cases, too, that I've worked, is the reliance on dogs to, you know, to do the investigation. I can understand, you know, having a dog used to look for something, but if you don't find it, I don't think that the fact that the dog alerted to something is good enough to send somebody to jail.
I don't either. I trained service dogs, and I know that dogs are very loving and very loyal, and they want to do what you want them to do so that they get positive feedback, positive reinforcement. And I just don't believe that if a dog goes in and sits, that means absolutely that they found something. I mean, I don't know if he is a certified dog trainer and can say, oh, well, he sat, so that meant that he's alerted. Could it possibly be the dog sat because he didn't find anything and you misinterpreted it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I mentioned to you, I live with 9 dogs. I'm married to a veterinarian. I mean, I love dogs, don't get me wrong. And they're incredibly intelligent and loyal creatures and everything else. But I don't think I'd be willing to send somebody to jail just based on a dog, whatever a dog is trying to communicate to me. Because I may not be quite understanding what the dog is saying. Or the dog may be saying something else. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know any trained dog person that can tell you they absolutely understand every signal or every communication that their dog tries to give them. I mean, that's just unheard of. We have no way to communicate with them, truly. They are very intelligent. They do help us a lot. I do know that they can sense things that we can't. And if you rely on that tool, I feel like it needs to be backed up with scientific testing. If that dog alerted all those times, what did the chemist say he found there? That was never done.
Rochelle served 14 years in prison. She made the most of the experience, earning a bachelor's degree in sociology. Although she maintained her innocence, she was not beyond getting discouraged. And prison was a frightening place for a young woman.
It's not a safe place in prison. I mean, you always have to watch yourself. The officers, there's officers that prey on inmates that have addictions. There's your fellow peers that prey on weak. You always have to, fear is always in the forefront. It should always be in the forefront because anything can happen at any time while you're in prison. I've seen officers beat up inmates down to officers having affairs with inmates.
How could you have an affair that people wouldn't know about?
Because the officers, they are all fellowships. So if one officer is running a unit, he'll tell his other officers to go off the unit, and then all he has to do at that point is slip inside a slop sink, which is basically like a utility room, and have sex or whatever he's going to do. because right when I was leaving New York is just when there had been so many cases of sex in the prison that they've made it a felony. So anybody that gets arrested for anybody that gets charged with having sex with an inmate and gets found guilty is charged as a sex offender, because while you're in prison, you don't have the right to give, I guess, right to have sex. So a lot of, and then others, you know, the officers are out there, they're free, they prey on you. When I was a target, because I didn't allow them to treat me any kind of way. I didn't allow them to say just anything to me. And I used to tell the other women, you shouldn't either. Just because you're in prison does not mean that you have to get down and have sex with this man. Just because you're in prison does not mean that you have to get cursed out by this woman. I didn't accept that when I was in prison. I'm already in a bad situation, and you are not going to make my situation worse.
In such an environment, it's easy to become discouraged. Rochelle says she lost hope of ever proving her innocence.
I'm going to be honest with you, sir. After about like 8 years, I had given up on myself. I had completely given up. I was tired of fighting. It just had to be what it was, because I knew no other way at that time. And then Cornell Institute came to see me one day, and they asked me how come I never spoke to them. And I said I never had heard about them, because I had all the lawyers of, like, innocent groups and stuff like that, but I didn't see Cornell listed. The guy asked me, the professor, he asked me, he said, he told me, he wasn't telling me he was going to take my case, but he wanted my permission to be able to review my case, and if he thought he could help me, he would write me back. And he wrote me back in, like, a month. And told me that he was interested in taking my case. And I had completely given up. And then what even touched me further, after I had gotten out, I found out that it was a social worker from Steuben County who then contacted a professor in Albany, which is the capital of New York, asking for help for me. But she couldn't disclose her name because she was a police officer's wife in that area. And she was just a simple social worker.
The Innocence Clinic at Cornell Law School advocated for Rochelle's freedom.
It became clear pretty quickly after that that this was not going to be one in which the state was going to take a look at what it had done and say, oh, wow, what a terrible mistake we've made. Let's try to make this right. They instead dug in. They had an early success in that the judge before whom the case went dismissed us without even giving us a hearing, and did so on a couple of grounds that we thought had real problems, and so we had to appeal it. And the appellate court seemed to agree that it had real problems, because they reversed it and sent it back within, I think, about 13 days of the oral argument, which... I don't do a lot of New York litigation, but I'm told that's almost record time. So back we went, and that's when we were placed on the calendar for an actual live in-court evidentiary hearing where we would have the opportunity to go in and prove what we had alleged about the junk science at the core of this case. And as it turned out, that hearing didn't happen because at the 11th hour, an agreement was reached.
Rochelle was given an ultimatum: plead guilty to a lesser offense and be immediately released, or fight and face years of continued incarceration as the case winds its way through the system.
There was sort of an 11th hour agreement that was reached pursuant to, so as I mentioned earlier, the sentence she was serving was 25 years to life, which, as I understand that under New York law, is much more likely to mean life than it is to mean 29 years. It's quite difficult to get parole in this state, as it is in many states. So this was a very long sentence. And the state proposed to us very near the time when we were supposed to be going back to court to present our evidence what amounted to, or what we tend to call, a time-served deal.
under which the original convictions would be vacated and replaced with new convictions to lesser offenses that for which she would have already served all of the time that she had to serve. So the net result of it is you go into court. In her case, she had to plead guilty, which was a very bitter pill to swallow, but it was a plea of guilty without any factual admissions, which I suppose eases it just a little bit. But the positive for her was that was the end of it. Once she did that, she walked out of the courtroom that day, and she did not owe the state of New York any more of her time. And you know, of course, making a decision to do something like that is not easy when you didn't commit the crime. But the reality is, even though, and I should add, you know, the state throughout never really had, and I don't believe would have had, any persuasive or even plausible defense to the allegations that we had made. You know, they never were in a position to say, no, the science was not junk, or the investigation really was sound. Nothing like that ever came from them in any communication that they made to us or to the court. So they didn't really have much of a defense. But what they did have on their side was the system.
One might think the day a person is released from prison would be a happy time, but Rochelle said it was a difficult one.
They said, June 1st, you're going to be released. You're going to be free. You're not going to have no parole. You're not going to have nothing. And that was June 1st of 2016. That was my first day out. And it was tough.
What was tough about it?
It was because you've been out of society for so long, and then you just drop back in.
Did you get to see your children?
Yes, my children came. They came to my hearing. And when we walked out, I walked out with my Cornell lawyer and my children. The judge said that she felt like justice had prevailed in this case. She didn't really say a lot. And then we left. It was the same judge that had convicted of me that told me that I was the most horrible person in the world. That's the same person you have to go back in front of.
And she said that she thought justice had prevailed, and that when you were released, or justice had prevailed when you were convicted.
When I was released.
Okay. Was it hard not to be angry at that judge?
Oh, it was very hard. But I had learned from prison. It's harder on you to be angry than to just let it go. Anger consumes a person and allows them to never move on. So that is one tough lesson that I learned in prison on my own. That sometimes that you just have to let things be as they are so you can continue living for now.
Suspect Convictions will begin a new season investigating a case of someone currently serving in a prison sentence who may have been wrongly convicted. Conducting these investigations is an expensive proposition. Witnesses need to be located and interviewed. Our journalists need to travel to crime scenes and prisons. And court cases, often in distant locations, need to be attended. Production costs are significant as well. Advertising doesn't cover the cost of these worthwhile endeavors. We want to continue to investigate and bring to light cases of those who have been wrongly imprisoned. If you would like to donate, please go to GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Again, to donate, please go to GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Your help would be much appreciated. The address again is GoFundMe.com/suspect-convictions. Thank you.